WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's April 5th, 2017, 5:10 in the morning. Glad to have you along for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day. Lots going on this morning. A little later in the program, we'll go to Motor City in Michigan to talk a little bit about this week's auto sales report, some new statistics there, and also whether or not Tesla is really taking over General Motors and Ford is one of the most profitable and one of the best or biggest car companies. That could be happening, and we'll talk to Dale Buss a little later in the program. And in just a few moments, we'll talk about gender and how sexuality might be impacting technology with an author in studio. But first, let's go to the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. There is some developing news on the Market Desk this morning. It involves Panera Bread, shares jumping 12% pre-market after it's agreed to be acquired by JAB in a $7.5 billion deal. Details on this are just coming in, so we'll have to get some more details for you. But Panera Bread is being acquired by JAB. It's a $7.5 billion deal. Panera shares are jumping this morning. Dow futures looking for a slight to modest opening on Wall Street this morning, up about 5 points. S&P and NASDAQ futures are lower this morning. Crude oil is trading higher by about 1%, up $51.60 a barrel. Let's check in on European markets. The FTSE is lower. The DAX is lower. The CAC is higher. Everything else in Asia is higher this morning. Asian shares are going to end higher as well. The Nikkei up about 51 points. The Hang Seng up about 139 points. Looks like a pretty decent day in Asia. Markets there appearing to shrug off the latest North Korean missile test, but trading is light ahead of U.S. data releases later this week, the meeting between the president of China and the U.S. president. All of the focus on that, obviously, on trade and the situation in North Korea. There are a couple of other stories that we're following for you this morning. A new report suggests that people living in urban minority neighborhoods, like urban minority neighborhoods here in Chicago, could be paying as much as 30% more for car insurance. An industry group says the report's findings are flawed, though. Nonprofit investigative news organization ProPublica and Consumer Reports published the analysis today based on insurance data from California, Illinois, Missouri, and Texas, detailing insurance claims payments by zip code. Those were the only states where regulators and the data was available. The Insurance Information Institute Trade Group has hired an independent expert to review the data, say the report is based on false data or not accurate data. And so that will be a story we'll be following over the next day or so to see just how it plays out. Today here on The Opening Bell, we're going to focus on the business of technology. And there's a new book by a Chicago author about how gender and sexuality impact the global computer revolution, specifically how Britain discarded women technologists and lost its edge in computing. Marie Hicks is a technology historian and assistant professor at Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. Her book is called Programmed Inequality, How Britain Discarded Women Technologists and Lost Its Edge in Computing. Marie, welcome to The Opening Bell.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a really interesting topic because it's one that we're kind of grappling with nonstop. But let's go back and talk about why you chose to write this book, why you focused on Great Britain.
Sure. Well, the reason I chose to write this book was because I actually worked as a Unix systems administrator for a little while. And while I was working in that job, it was interesting because all of the young men who I worked with, and it was almost all young men, who were about the same age, it was very clear that it was kind of a male-dominated field. But then our big bosses, who were a different generation, they were all women. And we would all kind of have conversations about, you know, well, why is that? And our bosses would say, you don't understand. It used to be different. There used to be more women around. And that kind of got me interested in looking into this gendered labor change. And the answer to the question of why Britain is that the United States is really big, but it's also really overstudied. And I think sometimes when we look at U.S. history, we have a harder time actually learning the lessons of the past. If we look at another country that's a little bit farther removed, sometimes we actually can get more applicable lessons.
They were also sort of leading this whole area of computer technology, were they not, back when you examined these areas?
Yes, 100% correct. That's the interesting thing about the UK. They have the first digital electronic programmable computers. They break codes with them during the war. That actually is the reason why the Allies know where to land at D-Day. It turns the tide of the war in the Allies' favor. And after the war, they make many more computing advancements. They're really matching the U.S. or leading us. And then by the 1970s, their computing industry has just imploded. And so there's a big question there. Well, why did that happen? And when I set out to write the book, that was also a question in my mind. But I didn't realize it was going to become so much a part of the story of gender that I was telling.
Back at the beginning, though, the folks who are operating these computers, is it fair to say that most of them were women?
That's 100% correct, because at the time, in the early days, the jobs really just weren't seen as important. They were feminized, which means not only were they done by women, but it also means that they were de-skilled, or at least they were seen as de-skilled. And so only women were hired for them. It wasn't until quite a bit later that they started getting a higher level of prestige.
It's I don't know how to even describe this, so maybe I'll let you describe it. But the book includes a lot of photographs of these women working. And they're portrayed in what way?
Well, it's interesting. It depends on whether the photographs are sort of candid or whether they're advertising photographs. But a lot of times they're portrayed almost as though they're secretaries or models. They're positioned in front of machines in a way that makes it look like they aren't really doing work, or the work that they're doing is not very difficult. They're pushing a single button or something like that. And the reason for this in advertising was to try to convince managers that they should buy these big expensive machines and that they wouldn't have to worry about a ton of outlay for staff, hiring experts and things like that. So it was a very clever marketing strategy. But one of the things it did is it really diminished women's skills. There's this ad that I love that's also in the book where it's talking all about the woman in the picture next to the computer and how this typist can do everything you need, right? She's going to do all the programming. Well, she's going to do all the programming, but somehow she's still a typist?
Yeah. And a couple more of the photographs. I mean, they almost remind me of pinups, those awful pinups. How did people view these photographs at the time, do you think? And talk to me more about the diminishing of the role here, because I would imagine that some people might see those photographs and not think there was intelligence involved.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there's one photo in the book that is very much a pinup picture. It's a picture of a woman who was a worker at one of these computer companies, and she's wearing just the bottom half of a bikini, and then she's holding the company magazine over her chest area. And, you know, that was a candid photo that was only meant for consumption within the company, but you can kind of infer what the climate was like being a woman worker in that company. If that was something that you were expected to do or encouraged to do, you were encouraged to take off your clothes and be on the cover of the company magazine. You know, she agreed to it, but who knows how she felt about it? That's kind of a hostile work environment.
Yeah, very much. And so the book talks about, and you mentioned earlier, from 1944 to 1974, from being the pinnacle of computer technology to being almost extinct. That's 30 years, basically. What did you find happened? What were the steps? Did they know it was happening while it was happening? And what lessons for the rest of the world are there here?
That's a great question, and it seems so obvious to us now looking back, but at the time, they saw what was happening and had no idea why. The British government and British industry were systematically pushing women out of computing jobs, but meanwhile, they didn't have enough labor to run computers, and so they're trying as hard as they can to get more people to basically be computer experts. But they're saying we're no longer going to use this mass of trained workers that we have because now we think these jobs are only for men. So they were essentially shooting themselves in the foot without knowing it. And, I mean, I think we can draw a lot of parallels to today.
Yeah. And so the lesson, too, for countries like the United States would be what?
Well, I think the lesson there is that discrimination hurts economies, whether it's gender discrimination, racial discrimination, discrimination on the basis of ability or sexuality or nationality. Right now, we're in a period where we're making it harder and harder in the U.S. for folks who are, say, here on H-1B visas or folks who are immigrants who are here perfectly legally. We're making it much harder for them to live and work and contribute to our society. And that's hurting them, but it's also hurting us in a very big way.
You describe this as labor feminization and gender technocracy. Did I say that correctly?
You did.
So these are the two things that you study as a professor. What do you tell students? And do you see any change here? Is it? I asked you this before we went on the air, but is there any improvement coming or happening?
There's definitely always change and there's always struggle and there's improvement and then there's kind of pushback. And I think we're in a period of pushback right now. So there's a lot of people resisting what's happening, trying to resist this rollback of progress of people's rights. And I think that's the best thing that you can do, you know, not assume that progress is going to be linear, but just kind of keep trying to push things forward because history doesn't just happen. Things don't just evolve or get better. It's always this process of struggle.
As we get our kids to learn more about STEM, the science and technology, engineering, math, core curriculum type areas, is there are we pushing them into something that may not be available? And you know, I ask because you've pulled a lot of research that shows that perhaps it's not all roses and sunshine. What are we preparing them for? What kind of careers are we, especially little girls?
That is a really, really great point. One of the ways that a field gets de-skilled or seems de-skilled is if people flood into it, especially if there's a flood of women into it, because low-status workers will make a field seem less important whether or not the content of the work has changed. That's happened historically, and it continues to happen today. So one of the dangers of all these getting women and girls into STEM initiatives is that if they really succeed in a big way and masses of women go into these fields, well, it's going to drag down the prestige and the pay of the fields. So that's a danger, of course, but then what's the alternative? To tell women, well, don't go into that field? Of course, we can't and we shouldn't do that. So the key, of course, is to focus on elevating people's status outside the labor market so that within the labor market, we don't end up getting these situations where people end up not being able to make a good living after they've trained for a high prestige field. And the other thing is, you know, this sort of thing always happens. A field that's very important in one decade is going to decline in the next, and that's just kind of inevitable. And we can't necessarily plan or train ahead for that. It's just the sort of thing that we have to know is on the horizon and be prepared to deal with when it comes.
It seems like, though, we're playing really bad game of fire with this, though, because technology is going to be the future of our planet. What are the possible repercussions if we don't do this right?
Well, you know, technology has been shaping society since the Industrial Revolution, since before the Industrial Revolution. And one of the things that has been a problem forever, for instance, is climate change and pollution. And we've been trying, you know, for centuries now to get that under control. So I think if we want to figure out, well, what's going to be a problem with this other form of electronic technology, we can look at older technologies and the problems that we've struggled with over the eras with them. So, they could be very, very severe, large-scale consequences. And what they're going to be specifically is maybe hard to pinpoint. But even in the most recent, say, political cycle, we've started to see the really broad ramifications that electronic technologies can have on our day-to-day lives.
And we've been talking a lot here about gender discrimination, but does this go across class and does it also go across race to the same extent?
Yes, 100%. I like to say oftentimes that gender is a classed category. All of these categories of oppression, essentially, they intersect with each other. So it's never just about, you know, elevating one or talking about one. It's always about all of them together. And one of the reasons that the women in my study, who they had an enormous amount of privilege in some ways, for instance, almost all of them are white. But on the other hand, they're also seen as working class or sort of pink collar. They're seen as not quite as important as their white collar peers, even though they're working right alongside them. So class was a very big aspect.
What else surprised you from the research that you did for this book?
Well, I guess the biggest thing that surprised me was that when I got into the archives, you know, it wasn't easy. I had to read through thousands and thousands of pages. But once I did that, the story just kind of unfolded in front of me. And it was just very obvious that the British government and British industry, they had just kind of shot themselves in the foot by discriminating against this huge section of their labor force. And they never saw it at the time. So that really surprised me. It made me realize there can be things going on that are going on for decades that are very obvious, seemingly, and yet people at the time will not understand what's happening.
We've, over this year already, we've talked about a couple of other instances with the movie The Hidden Figures, with the folks behind NASA, Glass Ceiling, the women who were behind finding some planets and doing astronomy at Harvard. And this is another story that do a lot of people know about it? And when they hear about these otherwise unknown stories, how does that impact how we try to change these situations?
Yeah. I always like to say that Margot Lee Shetterly's terrific book, Hidden Figures, it's sort of like the positive flip side to my book, because in her book, you know, the U.S. wins, essentially. They get the labor they need to get to make the changes to achieve the successes they need in the space program. And in the British case, what happens is the opposite, and it's a failure story. But we can learn important lessons from both of those. And I think that the most important thing in uncovering these hidden stories is to say, look, women were always there. Black people, black women, they were always there. They were doing this work. They were capable of a lot. And we shouldn't forget that. We shouldn't pretend that somehow this is a new thing. And we should show that when folks are able to live up to their potential, it's better not only for individuals, but for all of society. And when they're not, the reverse is true.
How concerned should we be about the current political climate, the new administration? It seems that as we learn more about what's happening, there's an anti-science, anti-technology, anti-women. It's hard to find any female faces on the cabinet or in the administration. How concerned should we be?
Well, I think we should be significantly concerned. I think that whenever you see a government that is becoming insular and isolated and cutting out a lot of people's voices and concerns, that's never good for a country. And because of the enormous power that the U.S. still has geopolitically in the world, that's not good for instance, the global economy or global politics. So I think it's fair to be concerned. And I think the thing to keep in mind is just that history is a struggle. You don't get progress without really trying for it. And it's just important to kind of keep pushing.
Aside from the politics, you bring up another point, and that's the economic part of this. Making the wrong decisions can be costly economically.
Yes, very much so. As you pointed out earlier, the end effect of what I describe in the book is that the British essentially lose their lead in computing and they lose their home computing industry. And this was a really big deal because that was a major industry. And more than that, the British saw technology as the way forward. They realized that as a fading empire in the 20th century, technology was going to be sort of their last best hope to regain their world status and their power in the world. And they lost it. And, you know, in a lot of ways, The reason I like studying Britain is because they're very similar to the United States. They're sort of like our big brother who gets there just a few steps ahead of us. So there's a lot to be learned from their missteps, and I just hope that we do.
You deal a lot in history. That's your main area. Care to talk about the future a little? What do you see in maybe 10 or 15 years or 20 years?
Well, I think that we're seeing major changes in some ways because hidden narratives like these are becoming more and more widely known and widely accepted. And I think the most important part of that is we're starting to understand that this idea of meritocracy is a fiction, that you can't just keep stuffing women or people of color into what's called the STEM pipeline and expect them to somehow succeed or come out the end and be, you know, captains of industry. That assumes a meritocratic structure that simply doesn't exist. And so one of the good things that I think is going on now is that we're having many more frank discussions about structural discrimination and how we need to really work on that instead of just assuming that this is something we can solve by just getting more bodies into these jobs.
The other books we talked about have become movies. Do you have any hope that this might become a movie? Any discussions about that, or are you even thinking about that yet?
No discussions, but hey, if you know anyone, put them in touch.
Marie, this is a wonderful book. Thank you very much for being here on The Opening Bell.
Thank you.
Marie Hicks is a technology historian and assistant professor at Illinois Institute of Technology here in Chicago. The book is called Programmed Inequality, How Britain Discarded a Women Technologist and Lost Its Edge in Computing. You can find out more about the books about the book at programmedinequality.com. You can also follow at Programmed Inequality. There is also a version, the intro of the book, that you can read there. We will continue our conversation, by the way, with Marie after the bell and post the full talk on our podcast of The Opening Bell a little bit later on this morning at WGNradio.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program, our Wednesday edition of The Opening Bell. Glad to have you along. Passenger car sales plummeted again in March, dragging U.S. auto sales to their third straight monthly decline. It's a strong indication that years of sales growth have come to an end. Let's find out what's going on. Off to Rochester Hills, Michigan. Dale Buss is a journalist for Forbes Chief Executives. We often go to him to talk about autos. Dale, good to hear your voice and talk to you again.
Yeah, likewise, Steve. Thanks for the interest.
How are you doing over there?
We're doing fine. As far as car sales are concerned, we haven't fallen off the edge of the earth. I know you used the word plummeted. I guess that's journalistic license, but I mean, definitely the sales cycle has peaked, and you know, people have predicted for years. I mean, going back, really honestly, 5 years ago, that sales had peaked, and the industry just continued to do well and push through old peaks, and are still selling around 17 million vehicles a year. So it's not time to panic, but it definitely. We're definitely seeing a leveling off of sales, and even more to the point, the sales that we do have, you know, they're off a couple of percent. Sales we do have now are supported by much more of an incentive activity by the automakers. So it's getting a lot more expensive for them to get consumers to buy their vehicles, especially cars, you know, as compared with SUVs and crossovers.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about who fared the best and who fared the worst in the latest numbers. Who would be at the top and bottom of that list?
Pretty much what we had are the domestic big three struggling the most, especially Ford. And it's kind of interesting because Ford is getting a lot of positive attention these days because of the investments the company is making in ride-sharing and self-driving technology, that kind of thing. But it's having problems selling cars. And Ford did so well several years ago with the Focus, Fusion, just a bevy of fuel-efficient small cars. When gas prices were $4 a gallon in 2008, that was great. But right now, Ford is particularly struggling selling those cars. And even though it has SUVs available, when you've got that much of your capacity devoted to cars, it's definitely going to hurt you.
Yeah, and the situation at Ford is, you know, good and bad. I mean, the sales of SUVs at Ford were really good, and trucks, right? They were higher.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I mean, at this point, the U.S. market is all about trucks, SUVs, and crossovers, and the traditional big three, including GM and Fiat Chrysler, are really well positioned when it comes to trucks, obviously. Not quite as much in SUVs, but in trucks they dominate. And as long as that's, you know, a major dynamic of the market or the most important dynamic of the market, they're going to be fine, especially profit-wise, because they make tens of thousands of dollars on trucks, you know, versus some cars they might make a few hundred dollars in profit. So as long as that dynamic is strong, which counts on a U.S. economy that would continue to be strengthening, and gasoline prices that, you know, remain relatively quiet.
Yeah, you mentioned the inventory, and some of the incentives that dealers are still doing. Are those going to continue? Are they going to get better for people who might be have been holding
yeah,
on?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're a consumer, I mean, especially if you want a sedan, this is really the time to buy, because dealers are you know, across the board, we're talking big three, but I mean, across the board, Honda, Nissan, Toyota, everybody, they have plenty of sedans to sell, and the incentives are only going to get better because the dynamics that have been in place for a while continue to get stronger. I mean, 3 years ago, 60% of vehicles that were sold roughly were cars, and 40% were SUVs, trucks, and crossovers. Now, that dynamic has completely flipped, and now we're pushing 65% trucks, SUVs, and crossovers. So that just tells you how dramatic the shift has been, and companies can't flip that easily. I mean, they're still making a lot of cars, so those are definitely where the best deals are going to be found.
Yeah, I saw a story in the Chicago Tribune yesterday. They went and talked to some area car dealers here in the Chicago area. The dealers are not too concerned about the situation. I think they are moving people through the lots. And that inventory is obviously a big deal, but dealers across the country generally aren't very concerned yet, are they?
No, I mean, even though we are definitely at the peak of the cycle or maybe coming down a little bit on the other side, I think that this concern about selling cars, the concern about the cycle, is balanced by at least a couple of things. One of them being the gasoline prices are still, you know, very decent. And the other is still a sense that the economy is going to pick up momentum and accelerate, you know, despite all of Trump's problems in so many different ways. The one dynamic that he has created is an expectation of stronger economic growth, and dealers and everybody else are kind of counting on that dynamic strengthening. You know, it's showing some signs of being there, but they definitely need a strengthening economy, or that optimism is going to start to slip for sure.
Yeah, one of the other highlights of the reports this week about autos is the one that I think got most of the headlines. Ford no longer the second most valuable U.S. auto company, losing out to Tesla. But is that really fair? I mean, is Tesla just a motor company? I don't think that's a fair comparison, is it?
Well, it isn't and it is. I mean, Tesla is, you know, eating the lunch of everybody when it comes to selling expensive electric vehicles. And actually, I think yesterday Tesla blew through the level of GM's capitalization as well. So there's an argument that Tesla is actually more valuable than either one of those companies, which, if you look at the other companies' assets, capacity, all that stuff, doesn't make any sense. But what Tesla has managed to figure out is how to sell electric vehicles. And it'll be interesting to see when they sell the Model 3, which is, you know, going to be mainstream priced in the 30,000s coming up within a year. Can they keep that kind of momentum going? Nobody does electrics better than Tesla. American consumers are finally warming up to electrics to some extent. So as long as they have that kind of pole position in that technology, investors are going to continue to flock to them. What'll be interesting is in the little bit more distant future, when it comes to automated driving, ride-hailing services, that kind of thing, Tesla does not have a market advantage over anybody, really. So the scrum is going to get a lot more interesting for Tesla, because everybody is doing what they're doing in the area of self-driving and you know, ride-hailing services, mobility services, that kind of thing. But for right, so actually, you might look at now as kind of the peak for Tesla in terms of market valuation and, you know, kind of having primacy in that particular area.
All right, Dale. Great chatting with you as always, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
Dale Buss is a journalist for Forbes, chief executive, regular contributor here on The Opening Bell on auto sales and the stats from this last month.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
5:53 back on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. We're looking for a week open on Wall Street later this morning. Dow futures are flat and NASDAQ and S&P futures are now lower. Crude oil is trading up just about a half a percent this morning. Gold and silver are trading lower. Let's bring in Orion Samuelson. Happy to have Orion back today. It's a treat for all of us with the latest on commodities and agriculture. Good morning, Orion.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be back with you, and thanks for doing all the chores you were doing while I was away. But we're back to look at a market that's come under pressure, really. Yesterday, soybean futures fell to their lowest level in a year, pressured by expectations for record large plantings in this country and a record South American harvest. Corn futures down 1% on profit taking, and May soybeans settled down half a cent a bushel, but did hit 936 and a half during the day, which is the contract's lowest since April 8th of 2016. And the May corn fell 4¾ cents a bushel. As we take a look at livestock trade yesterday at the Mercantile Exchange, lean hog futures fell to their lowest level since early December. More than enough supplies dragging down cash prices for a ninth straight session. April hogs ended down $1.12 a hundredweight in yesterday's trade. And cattle futures also moved lower thanks to some technical selling and some sell stops. Softer cash price expectations for this week discouraged futures buyers in the market yesterday. One other note on the international scene, the China National Chemical Corporation, ChemChina, has won U.S. antitrust approval to buy Switzerland's Syngenta on condition that it divest itself of three pesticides in that portfolio. That's a look at the agribusiness story this morning. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuels.
All right. Thanks, Orion. You have a great day as well. And again, welcome back. Good to have you back on board. Let's check the WGN Associated Bank calendar market outlook for this Wednesday. It is April 5th, 2017. The Institute for Supply Management releases its monthly non-manufacturing survey. The Federal Open Market Committee publishes its minutes for the last Federal Reserve book, for the Federal Reserve minutes of the last meeting. World's Best Restaurants announced today the 16th annual S. Pellegrino World's 50th Best Restaurants Awards are presented in front of some of the world's leading chefs and restaurants. That's going to be happening in Melbourne, Australia, I believe. The Country Music Hall of Fame inductees are announced today for 2017 at a news conference in Nashville. And this is Star Trek Contact Day. Doubt that's going to impact the markets at all, but for Star Trek fans, this is the day that Earth's first contact with the Vulcans was made fictionally in the movie and in the TV series in 2063.